طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the mainstream media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Today we focus on how the well-financed Israeli lobby is shaping the Palestine-Israel discourse in communities, the media, and in our state legislatures across the country. We feature reports on two incidences which took place over the course of the last few weeks, which are illustrative of the strategy of the Israeli lobby to challenge the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, movement. These incidences illustrate the depth of the Israeli lobby's strategy to obstruct the reach of Palestinian BDS movement in its attempts to shape media reporting, as it did in the Associated Press firing of Emily Wilder, and through the development of state laws to outlaw the BDS movement as it has in Texas and other states. These are not isolated incidents. Similar scenarios are taking place all across the country. It demonstrates the strategy of the lobby to silence criticism of Israel. First, we go to Democracy Now!'s report of the Associated Press's firing of Emily Wilder because of her relationship with Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace while she was in college. Behind it all, the Israeli lobby. Here is a lowdown reported by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the Associated Press News Service is facing growing criticism for firing a young reporter after she was targeted by a right-wing smear campaign for her pro-Palestinian activism while she was a college student at Stanford. Emily Wilder is Jewish. She was a member of Students for Justice in Palestine and also the group Jewish Voice for Peace at Stanford University before she graduated in 2020. She was an intern at the Arizona Republic before the AP hired her for an entry-level role in Phoenix, and was 2 weeks into her new job when the Stanford College Republicans began highlighting some of her past tweets. Their campaign was then amplified by right-wing media and politicians, including Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton. The AP says it fired Wilder for violating its social media policy. The decision came just days after Israeli forces bombed the building housing the AP's office in Gaza. 10 senior AP executives stood by the decision to fire Emily Wilder, noting in a leaked memo to editorial staff, quote, "We did not make it lightly," referring to the decision. The AP's executive editor, Sally Busby, did not sign the memo. She begins her new job next month as executive editor at the Washington Post. She's making history as the first woman executive editor of the Washington Post. She told NPR she has, quote, "handed over day-to-day operations at AP, so, quote, I was not involved in the decision at all." Meanwhile, journalists at the AP protested Wilder's firing in an open letter Monday, writing, quote, "It has left our colleagues, particularly emerging journalists, wondering how we treat our own, what culture we embrace, and what values we truly espouse as a company," unquote. For more, we go to Phoenix, Arizona, to speak with Emily Wilder in her first television broadcast interview. We're also joined by Janine Zakaria, who was Emily Wilder's journalism professor at Stanford University. She's the former Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Emily, why don't you just take us through what happened to you?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Last Monday, a group from my alma mater, the Stanford College Republicans, began to post online past posts that I had made on social media in an attempt to expose my history of activism for Palestinian human rights while I was an undergraduate at Stanford University, and in an attempt to link AP to Hamas. In the next 2 days, I began to receive a lot of harassment, a lot of pretty heinous harassment, as well as prominent Republicans on the internet began to lambast me, including Senator Tom Cotton and Ben Shapiro. I was reassured during this time by my editors that I would not face repercussions for my past activism and that they just wanted to support me while I was facing the smear campaign. But less than 48 hours after the Stanford College Republicans began to post about me, I was fired. The reason given was a supposed social media violation sometime after I joined AP on May 3rd. I was not given an explanation for what social media policy had violated or what tweet had violated policy, and I still have not received an explanation.
And Emily, when you were originally hired, what were you told by the Associated Press of what its social media policy was for its reporters?
Well, I was told that reporters must not share opinions online, must not show bias in coverage.
And you were covering, what were you covering while you were at the AP?
Well, I was hired as a news associate on the West Desk, which covers the Western United States, 14 states in the Western United States. And my position is not actually a reporting position. It was an entry-level kind of apprenticeship, an editorial and production apprenticeship. And so I was concerned with assisting coverage on the in the Western United States.
So in effect, why would these folks at Stanford target you? It seems almost nonsensical that they would go after you in this concerted and campaign like manner.
Well, first of all, this is not my first encounter with this group. During my time at Stanford, they built a reputation as kind of bullies. They antagonized really any student they disagreed with. And I was in their crosshairs more than once. So they knew my name, and I guess they did not forget about me. And I can't say for certain why they did what they did, but perhaps they learned that I had joined a national news organization at a moment that news organization was under public scrutiny, and they took it as an opportunity to both smear me and smear the Associated Press.
On Monday, the union representing Washington Post reporters, now, of course, Emily was working for the AP, but the union representing Washington Post reporters tweeted, quote, "Solidarity with the staff of the AP and Emily Wilder. We hope management provides swift answers on her termination and clarifies the newsroom's social media practices," unquote. The AP said in a memo to staff Monday it plans to review its social media policies. Now, the significance of the Washington Post Writers Union expressing solidarity is that Sally Busby, the executive editor of AP, is going to become the first woman executive editor of the Washington Post beginning in June, which brings us to our next guest, Janine Zakaria, a professor at Stanford University who taught Emily Wilder. You were the Washington Post's bureau chief in Jerusalem, is that right, about a decade ago?
That's correct.
So can you talk about this controversy?
So I want to speak on about it on two levels. I want to speak personally as Emily's instructor at Stanford, what this has been like. And then I want to speak in the macro about what I think is really happening here. So personally, I want to say that when Emily called me to tell me that she had been fired by the AP, I literally was shocked. I was really shocked because... and I really didn't know what to say. And I said to Emily, close your laptop. I need to call you back because I really need to think about what's happening here, what we're going to do, and how am I going to help my brilliant former student continue with a career in journalism? Because, yes, I spent most of my career, close to two decades, reporting on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I started my career as a young woman in Jerusalem before in an earlier incarnation in the 90s for Reuters. So I am very aware, perhaps more than most, to the sensitivities of around the questions of bias and reporting on the conflict. Nevertheless, as was mentioned, in this case, it wasn't about bias, and it wasn't even about, I don't think, social media policies, because if you review what Emily posted, since she started at the AP, there was one tweet that mentioned a mild opinion about the question of objectivity and on reporting on the conflict and the language we use. And an editor could have come to her and said, I think you should take down that tweet because it expresses an opinion in violation of our social media policies. Doesn't mean you can't have these opinions, but you can't broadcast them on social media. But I think that the bigger issue in this case, if you read the letter of her dismissal, was that it mentions you cannot have any conflict that could be perceived as a bias or leading to accusations of bias. Something to that effect was the language. And so when Stanford College Republicans documented some of her pro-Palestinian activism in college, I think they got a little spooked because it was in the context, as Emily mentioned, of Israel's strike on the Gaza Bureau and Hamas. And people who wanted to defend that strike were trying to accuse AP of knowingly sharing a building with Hamas when Hamas rules the Gaza Strip for 15 years. They're everywhere. And this was a way to continue to fuel that narrative. Look, you hired this news associate who has pro-Palestinian views. And so it really was a full-on disinformation campaign against not only Emily, but the AP. These are actors who are not interested in having a serious conversation about how we cover the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They want to take down credible, fact-based news organizations.
And Janine Zakaria, what are some of the unusual pressures that reporters who are covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have to deal with, especially here in the United States?
You know, I think the number one is this perception of there's a couple. Okay, first of all, it's a conflict of dueling narratives, and when you are trying to do objective reporting on the conflict, you do, and this, you know, this is the way it is. You try and figure out what's going on, what do people say happened at that checkpoint, what happened right now with the bombing of the building, whatever, and you evaluate the information that's given to you. If you take a walk in my inbox from, 2009, 2010, 2011, when I was there for the Washington Post, social media was still in its infancy, but I received so much hate mail. Nothing like what happened to Emily now could have happened to me because there were no Twitter mobs back then, really. You're pro-Zionist, you're pro-Palestinian, you're this, you're that. And it could be very intense. You know, I remember when I covered, there was an incident of what was called the flotilla, the Mavi Marmara, was an aid shipment going to Gaza, and I was in the Gaza Strip for the Washington Post. And I got woken up around this time, 4 or 5 a.m., and I was told that the Israelis, IDF had killed, maybe it was, the Navy or whatever, whoever, there was images of them dropping onto this Turkish aid ship, had killed 9 people. And so I started writing for the Washington Post. I was doing radio, and I got a call that night from a very senior Israeli official yelling about this A1 story I'd written for the Washington Post. The Israelis hadn't released any information. It was like we were trying to struggle. It was hard, in other words. So you do your best to cover this conflict as best as you can. And what I do at Stanford is take people like Emily, brilliant, students who care about the world, who have deep social conscience, who study history, who know what's going on in the world. And I try to train them to channel that social conscience into accountability journalism. And what's so distressing to me about this incident is Emily shouldn't have to and can never erase who she was, right, before joining the AP. And if they decide that because she was a pro-Palestinian activist attacked by a student group, amplified by a right-wing smear campaign against her, then they're going to, what does this mean? Does this mean that any student who was an activist in college, which is what students do, they're activists in college, can't become a journalist? What, you know, what happens if they're activists on abortion or climate change? Or is this specifically about Israeli-Palestinian conflict because of the pressures that these news organizations feel?
I wanted to read what Ari Paul, who wrote about Emily Wilder for FAIR, later wrote on Facebook. He said, she was not some famous firebrand. She wasn't appointed to some high-level post like Jerusalem correspondent. She's a college grad who had a low-level job at a domestic bureau. But it's clear that right-wing organizations are keeping tabs on all sorts of college activists and keeping track of where they end up working. And the right is clearly organized to follow and stalk them and ruin their lives, or at least attempt to. Emily, can you comment on this and talk about what the Associated Press said to you before you joined? I mean, it wasn't a secret that you were part of your Jewish student. You were part of Jewish Voice for Peace. And also, you were part of the group for Justice in Palestine.
I think that that post is absolutely right, especially considering my post was in the Western United States. My beat was totally unrelated to the Middle East. Like Janine said, yes, I have opinions about the Israel-Palestine conflict as a citizen of the world, but also as a Jewish American who grew up in a Jewish community. And yes, I have a history of activism on that issue. Neither of those facts prevent me from being able to do fair, credible, fact-based reporting, especially when the beats are entirely unrelated to the Middle East. But also, I want to take it a step further and say that the values that led to my activism, the values of compassion and justice that compelled me to speak out loudly and advocate for Palestinian human rights, those values are powerful assets in my reporting, and I don't think newsrooms should try to get me to yield those values. And I really hope that I can continue to channel those values in accountability journalism, like Janine said.
I also want to point out that more than 100 Associated Press employees signed a letter in support of you, Emily, that read in part, quote, Wilder was a young journalist unnecessarily harmed by the AP's handling and announcement of its firing of her. We need to know that the AP would stand behind and provide resources to journalists who are the subject of smear campaigns and online harassment. I also wanted to ask both Emily and Professor Zakaria about this timing of when this happened. You know, I was watching while Sally Busby said she's not involved with day-to-day now at AP because she's going over to the Washington Post to head that news organization. She was on television talking about the bombing of the AP offices in Gaza, talking about calling for an investigation and the intimidation this meant for the fact that there would be fewer voices reporting out of Gaza and how critical that was. Emily, if you could talk about this, and then I'd also like to ask Janine Zakaria to go broader, both of you, on the coverage of Israel and Palestine. There was just a major petition that was signed by many to Canadian journalism organizations talking about the fact that they're not even supposed to use the word Palestine.
I can't really speak to which executives within the Associated Press were involved in the decision to fire me, partly because I received so little information when I was fired, and still I have received so little information. But I agree with you, the timing is really important to the story here. I mean, it's a perfect storm. We have the event in Gaza with the AP office a couple days ago. We have people have made links between my treatment and the treatment of other journalists like Chris Cuomo on CNN. And we also have, this is also happening within a moment that newsrooms are reckoning with this question about social media, objectivity, past activism, diversity of life experiences. And I think that that's why, you know, my former colleagues at the Associated Press, that's partially why they felt so compelled to speak out. And seeing that is really encouraging and uplifting as a young journalist.
I should also point out that and a number of others have done this. Wolf Blitzer, a main anchor on CNN, formerly worked for AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He hasn't been fired or preventing from reporting on Israel and Palestine. Professor Janine Zakaria, would you like to comment?
You know, I just there's so many things that are upsetting about all this. But, you know, if you're going to go down the road of, in general, of, okay, well, you know, Emily was with Jewish Voice for Peace and Wolf Blitzer was for AIPAC, you know, the answer has to be, you know, judge your reporters based on their work, right? Because it's insane to think that journalists don't have passions and opinions, because the very people who go into journalism, as you very well know, Amy, are people who are passionate and have opinions about things in the world. And so it's just that's distressing. And also, I just want to echo something that Emily said about how they still haven't told her really what's going on. To me, as her instructor, as someone who maybe feels like I entrusted my young student with them, this is shocking to me that they didn't do more to sort of talk to her about it. And I think it's because it really wasn't about social media policy. And this is something that the AP and other news organizations really need to think about. Who are we going to let work in our newsrooms? How are we going to deal with, I mean, if you have, for example, a whole generation of students who went to Black Lives Matter protests last summer, and then they come and take my journalism class at Stanford or another university, and they say, you know what, I want to be a journalist, and their lives live on TikTok and Instagram and all that. Are all these journalists not? Are these students not going to be able to be journalists now? I mean, are there not top managers in news organizations who were in anti-Vietnam protests in the 60s and their lives live on Instagram? Or is this specific to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which, as you noted, the coverage is shifted the very week that Emily got caught up in this? You had the bombing of the AP bureau in Gaza. You had a very visceral reaction by the American public to the Israeli attacks in Gaza in a way that you did not have in 2014 when 2,200 Palestinians were killed. You didn't see this kind of reaction. You had on the A1 of the New York Times on Sunday a story about the brutality of life under Israeli occupation. These are all very unusual. Look on the New York Times today in terms of a letter from Gaza that really calls into question a lot of the Israeli narrative about Hamas and what's really happening in Gaza. I mean, there's a major shift going on. And so, you know, I think that Emily, in a way, the reason that she's seeing a lot of support is I was worried. I wanted to make sure she had support. And you're seeing that because it's coming at that moment. Thank God, because I can't tell you again how distressing this has been for me as her instructor and someone who cares so deeply about her.
A major...
Emily...
Go ahead, Juan.
Emily, I wanted to ask you, how has this the last few days shaped your view of journalism and what you want to do as a journalist?
Yeah, it's really rocked my perspective, honestly. I mean, obviously. You know, I wanted to join the AP because while, like everybody on this earth, I do have opinions, and those opinions fuel my passion for journalism. I wanted to join the AP because I am capable at doing fact-based accountability journalism. That is what I really excelled at the Arizona Republic, and that's why the AP hired me. And they were aware that I cared about the world. They were aware that I had a commitment to justice and marginalized communities. So I thought I would be welcome in a newsroom like AP. But, you know, I was also aware of this broader history that I'm just one example in of media institutions unfairly applying these rules about objectivity and social media haphazardly when expedient in a way that generally comes down hardest on journalists of color, journalists who have ever spoken out on Israeli policy, and in a way that just reinforces status quo politics. So I was aware of that, and I, you know, I was witnessing these shifts in the industry. I thought I'd be welcome, but now I know that this experience, I guess, could have made me question my commitment to those values that, you know, compel me to do journalism. But I will not yield them. And now I know that I need to channel them into journalism in a team, in an organization that is similarly aligned.
And finally, Professor Janine Zaccaria, what are you going to teach your students as they come back to Stanford now about what this means for journalism? In the end, because of Emily's outspokenness and bravery in taking this on instead of slinking away, do you think journalism will advance in this country, and particularly around the Israel-Palestine issue?
Well, I scrapped my class in foreign correspondence on Thursday that I had planned, and we're devoting it to this because it's so important, obviously. Emily's a peer and a friend of many of the students in my current class who have been very traumatized by this whole thing, wondering again, you know, whether they have a future in journalism, you know, reaching out to me quite shell-shocked. And so I feel the need as their instructor to talk about what's happened. But I don't know what to say, you know, truthfully, Amy, because what I do as someone who started at Reuters, worked at the Washington Post, at the conventional media, you know, what I train them to do, I don't know. I just don't know what to say right now. I'm still processing it all. But what I will do is hold up Emily as an example of what I believe they all should do, is use their brilliance and channel their convictions into amazing reporting that gets picked up by Amy Goodman and others. She had another story, by the way, about wait times for COVID testing that was featured on Rachel Maddow as an intern, right? So in the end, you know, I'll stress that this is really the AP's loss, and whoever hires her next is going to be so very fortunate.
The Emily Wilder incident has all the markings of the use of the canary list, a list of pro-Palestinian activists used by the Israeli lobby to blacklist enemies of Israel. This is how the lobby operates, and it is most unfortunate that corporations like the Associated Press cave into it. Several states, including Texas, have passed laws that punish the boycotting of Israel. Here is a story of a victim of the Texas law, which literally outlaws the support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement throughout the state. Here's how it works, as told by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now!
A Palestinian-American teacher in Austin, Texas, has filed a federal lawsuit for losing her job as a speech pathologist after refusing to sign a pro-Israel oath. Bahia Amawi is an Arabic-speaking child language specialist who had worked for 9 years in the Pflugerville Independent School District, but she lost her job last year after she declined to sign a pledge that she, quote, will not boycott Israel during the term of the contract, unquote, and that she will not take any action that is, quote, intended to penalize, inflict economic harm on, or limit commercial relations with Israel.
Before filing the lawsuit Monday, Bahia Amawi spoke to The Intercept about what happened to her.
The point of boycotting any products that supports Israel is to put pressure on the Israeli government to change its treatment, the inhumane treatment of the Palestinian people. Having grown up as a Palestinian, I know firsthand the oppression and the struggle that Palestinians face on a daily basis. You know, I have to set an example for my kids. We got to stand up for what's the justice and for right and equal opportunity for everybody and humane conditions. And so for me, it was an easy decision in that aspect. You know, I could not sign it. I was forced to depart from my job because I will not sign it, and I cannot return back if I don't sign it. I have been here in the States for over 30 years. I'm an American citizen. I follow the law. And so I have the luxury of having these rights, which many people in other countries do not have. it infringed on all my principles. And on top of that, my right to speech and also right to protest. It's baffling that they can throw this down our throats, you know, and decide to protect another country's economy versus protect our constitutional rights.
Last year, Texas became one of 26 states with laws preventing state agencies from contracting with companies or individuals aligned with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. BDS is an international campaign to pressure Israel to comply with international law and respect Palestinian rights. However, its opponents say BDS is a thinly disguised anti-Semitic attempt to debilitate or even destroy Israel.
Democracy Now! Reached out to the Pflugerville Independent School District in Texas, which responded with a statement saying it had, quote, followed state law, which does not allow school districts to hire a contractor unless the contract contains a written verification that the contractor does not boycott Israel and will not boycott Israel during the term of the contract. The plaintiff did not agree to the contract as written. Therefore, it was unable to be executed in accordance with Texas law, unquote. Well, for more, we go to Austin, Texas, where we're joined by Bahia Amawi. In Chicago, her attorney, Gadir Abbas, is with us, a senior litigation attorney with CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Bahia. Explain exactly what happened and how you noticed what was in this contract. I mean, you've been teaching in the school district. This is a public school, is that right? For how long?
This is a public school, and I have been contracting with them for around 9 years. And every year I get a contract that's exactly a duplicate of the year before. And this year I got it as well, the contract at the initial start of my month, which is August, when school begins. And so I signed the initial contract. It was exactly the same as I sign every year. But then later on, a few weeks later, my speech coordinator contacted me and says, oh, Bahia, we have additional papers this year. This is brand new, and we need people to sign it. So when I received the papers, I looked through it. There was about maybe a stack of four sheets of paper with a bunch of new compliances and new codes. They appeared to be normal job-related issues like background history, criminal history, equal opportunity employment, until I came across the one that has nothing to do with my job, which is code 2270.01 of the Texas government code. And at that one, I was reading it, and it states that currently the contractor must affirm that currently does not or will not boycott Israel and basically, in short, causing any economic harm. So that's when I noticed then I sent an email immediately, and I stopped even reading the additional codes. And I sent an email to my speech coordinator telling her, listen, I cannot sign this. This is against my principles, against my constitutional rights. And it's also against my moral and ethical values, considering that I am a Palestinian American and I have family that actually live in occupied territory, so it affects me personally as well. So it affects me in both ways, as an American citizen and as a Palestinian American too. She was kind enough. We have a really good relationship with her, and I've known everybody for 9 years, so I have a really good relationship with everybody at the school district. And she tried, she said, let me see if I can go around it. After 2 weeks, she returned back to me and apologized and said, I'm really sorry, Bahia, but they said they will not pay you if you do not sign this part of the new compliances. And so I kind of had to, forcefully leave at that point and couldn't return.
And Bahia Maui, now, were you aware that this law had been passed in Texas at all? Had you heard anything in the media about it? And why did you decide then that you needed to seek an attorney's help in challenging this?
I did not. I was not aware that this law was passed. I've heard of it in other states, but I did not know it was passed in Texas. It was kind of went under, undetected, I think. It wasn't something they advertised or talked about much in the media. And I'm not a social media person, so I'm not always online. I have four kids, so I'm very busy with them. So I'm not, I don't go on Facebook or look up things or anything. So I really had no aware of this new law being passed. And when I saw it, it just was unfair in so many ways. It just did not make sense. It was baffling to me and shocking that my
position as a speech therapist, helping kids, you know, with their speech and, you know, develop with their communication in the elementary school affects any economic harm in Israel. So to me, it's just nothing made sense at all of this. And it was a violation of everything, violation of my freedom of speech, right to protest, my constitutional right. And so it was actually a no-brainer. I knew that I had to do something about it. And I didn't want this to grow into something more, which it can possibly, and affect, you know, everybody, including my kids when they go to the universities. Who knows if they ask us, you know, in a state university, if they have to sign it before registering for classes. You know, it may grow into something more. And I knew I had to do something about it.
I want to look a little more closely at the language contained in the contract. It asks our guest, Bahia Maui, to sign a pledge that she does not currently boycott Israel and that she will, quote, not boycott Israel during the term of the contract. The contract goes on to explain, boycott Israel means refusing to deal with, terminating business activities with, or otherwise taking any action that's intended to penalize, inflict economic harm on, or limit commercial relations specifically with Israel, or with a person or entity doing business in Israel or in an Israeli-controlled territory, but does not include an action made for ordinary business purposes. So, let me bring your lawyer into this conversation, Ghadir Abbas. This is one of 26 states that has passed similar laws. In this case, if Bahia was to simply say to a friend, I am not going to buy something that is made in the occupied territories that Israel is selling in the United States, this would make her in violation of the law?
Yeah. Bahia would be disqualified from working for any school district in the state that's following this law simply because she chooses not to buy, for instance, Sabra hummus. So her grocery store decision to not buy Sabra hummus and to buy instead another kind of hummus automatically under this law disqualifies her from all public employees, all public employment of all kinds. And here, Bahia is engaged in core protected activity that really has a hallowed place in American tradition, from boycotts against British tea, from the Montgomery boycott, from the boycott against apartheid South Africa. Bahia's actions and choices to spend her money in a particular way are expressive conduct that are protected by the First Amendment. And here, the state of Texas is siding with a foreign country's policy preferences over the needs of Bahia's students. And let's remember, here in the final analysis, Bahia's students are being deprived of their speech pathologist in exchange for accommodating the policy preferences of a foreign country. That's illegal and objectionable.
Now, Ghadir Abbas, given that there are 26 states that now have similar laws in place, legislation that has gotten very little, if any, national attention, it must indicate that there is an intensive lobbying effort going on at the state level, either by the state of Israel or by lobbying groups employed by groups in defense of the state of Israel. Do you know anything about this lobbying campaign that's been going on?
Well, it's extremely successful. In Texas, for example, it passed the legislature almost unanimously on a bipartisan basis. These bills have passed with relatively little controversy, and it's only escalated. Congress right now, it's Ben Cardin, a Democrat, who is pushing to include a criminal version of this state law and the continuing resolution that is set to expire on Friday. And so we might have, by the end of this week, a federal law that criminalizes the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and the activity associated with it. And here it just goes to show that for some issues, and Israel and Palestine are one of them, that the pro-Palestinian voices, the folks that are advocating for Palestinians to have equal rights, don't have necessarily an ally in the Democratic Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and really must look to the activists and the movement for Palestinian rights itself to vindicate these basic rights to speak out in favor of Palestinian rights.
Bahia Maui, are you an active member of the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement?
I am not actually an active member of the BDS at all. I'm just personally for myself, if I'm aware of a product that is, you know, supports Israel or is made in the country, then I just have a personal, I make a personal choice to avoid it because I don't want to support their ongoing occupation and aggression and in subhumane treatment of the Palestinians. That's making me kind of like a silent participant, complicit with the whole occupation. So I actually, I'm not aware of it. I didn't even go through and find out the list of things. I just happen to know about it, or, you know, if somehow I find out, then I just avoid it. But other than that, really, I'm not an active member.
And what's been the reaction of your fellow employees at the school or other teachers as well to the results of what's happened to you in this case?
Yeah, well, so when I had to forcefully leave, I notified my coworkers, my co-evaluators that I work on an early childhood team, which are the ones that I'm usually in association with, and they depend on me to do the Arabic evaluations. So when I told them, they were kind of shocked because after 9 years, they were like, you know, why? What's happening? What's changed all of a sudden? So that's when I shared with them this new compliance, and they were just disturbed as much as I was and appalled. And they supported me, and they say, you know, we understand and we hope you do, you know, pursue and do something about it. So they were very encouraging and very supportive, and they were hoping that I can return eventually, which is my goal. I want to be able to go back to work again, because there's a need for a speech therapist who speaks Arabic to evaluate students who have Arabic as a second language. It is actually beneficial to be a speech therapist with another language, bilingual, another language. It's such a need all over.
Ghadir Abbas, is there any reference to any other state, any other country in this kind of contract that you have to sign, a kind of oath to another country?
No, there's no other country that's mentioned in the state of Texas law. There's no other country mentioned in any of these laws in the more than 25 states that have passed them or the executive orders that have been issued by governors. This is only about Israel, and it really is unique in American history to have a law that specifically prevents Americans from boycotting a particular foreign country. I've never seen any kind of historical analog to what we're seeing here. And the fact of the matter, though, is that free speech rights in the United States are very well protected. And boycott activity, Supreme Court and other courts have held over and over again, is a core expressive action that Bahia and others are welcome and entitled to take. And so whatever the state of Texas and the governor of Texas believes, and it's obviously he's cast his lot with Israel rather than Texas citizens like Bahia, who are put in the position of losing their job or advocating for their beliefs. The Constitution is designed, and the Bill of Rights exists to protect Bahia's right to protest the policies of Israel and in the occupied territories as she sees fit.
Ghadir Abbas, I want to thank you for being with us, senior litigation attorney with CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, representing Bahia Maui and her lawsuit against the Pflugerville Independent School District and the state of Texas. When we come back, we'll be joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, who wrote about Bahia's case in The Intercept. And we'll talk about these laws around the country and what is the legal record when they're challenged in places like Kansas and Arizona. Are these laws struck down? Stay with us. here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to Glenn Greenwald, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, one of the founding editors of The Intercept. His latest piece headlined, "A Texas Elementary School Speech Pathologist Refused to Sign a Pro-Israel Oath, Now Mandatory in Many States, So She Lost Her Job." Glenn, why don't you talk about, you know, exposing this story nationally? But we're talking about the law in Texas. In fact, more than half the states in the United States have a contract like she was being forced to sign if she wanted to keep her job as a speech pathologist.
So there are 26 states in the U.S. that have some version of this Texas law. They're not all as severe as the one in Texas, though many of them are. Others have various kinds of restrictions on people who boycott Israel, prohibiting the expenditure of any funds to invest in companies, for example, or in pension funds that have companies that invest, that advocate a boycott of Israel. They all have one thing in common, which is that they impose limitations on the opportunities and abilities of private citizens or private companies that support or participated in the boycott of Israel. I think the most extreme example, Amy, that actually stuns me the most is Andrew Cuomo in New York, who in 2016 issued an executive order because he couldn't get it passed through the legislature, barring New York state agencies from doing business with companies that boycott Israel, and he actually ordered them to compile a public list that would be published on a website of any companies that were found to be boycotting Israel. Yes, I can.
Well, Glenn, if you could talk further about how public do you have to be in violation of the law? If you say to a friend you're not going to buy a product from Israel because you don't want to support the occupation by the Israeli state of the occupied territories, you have to be a card-carrying member, if they have cards, of BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement. What would lead you, how would a law like Texas's, when would they say you have violated the law?
So I'm not sure if you were able to hear that last answer at the end of it. I was talking about the law imposed by Andrew Cuomo in New York, where he ordered the agencies to use public information to compile a list of companies who said they were boycotting. In the case of Texas, they're really just relying on the word of the contractor. So Bahia or others could just lie and say, I promise not to boycott Israel, even though they really are. Presumably, you could get someone fired if you find out that they really are supporting the boycott of Israel. And the point I was making about New York and other states is that at the same time that, for example, Governor Cuomo ordered a boycott or barred a boycott of Israel, 2 months earlier, he ordered his state employees to boycott North Carolina in protest of an anti-LGBT law that that state had adopted. So in Andrew Cuomo's worldview and the worldview of Texas, you're allowed to boycott other American states and harm American businesses and be employed. You're just not allowed to harm or boycott this one foreign country, Israel. You can boycott Canada or Russia or anybody else. It's just special protection for Israel that not even American businesses enjoy. That's what makes it so shocking.
And Glenn, this prospect of the possibility of an omnibus budget bill being passed with a similar legislation at the national level, could you talk about that and how little attention it's gotten?
Yeah, so last year, a Democratic senator from Maryland, Benjamin Cardin, who's one of the most loyal AIPAC supporters, introduced a bill that would actually make it a crime, a felony, to participate in an international boycott of Israel. And it attracted 43 co-sponsors, 29 Republicans, 14 Democrats. And the ACLU screamed and yelled about this. They issued warnings saying this was one of the gravest threats to free speech they had ever seen. A bunch of Democratic senators who had co-sponsored it, like Kirsten Gillibrand and others, withdrew their support. But now Cardin is back with a somewhat watered-down version, but still very threatening, that's designed to uphold the state laws and also to allow financial penalties on the federal level for anyone participating in the boycott. He's trying to sneak it through a bill that has to be passed, the lame duck budget bill. So there's no separate vote on this. He would just sneak it in there. And the ACLU is trying to do everything they can to warn people of the grave threat posed by Senator Cardin and his allies to make it a federal crime to participate in the boycott of Israel.
Well, the very act of getting all of this legislation passed to prevent people from participating in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement seems to indicate that there is a growing fear that the movement is having an impact.
Of course, it is having an impact. In fact, we now have two members of Congress, newly elected members of Congress, who are the first Muslim women to be elected to the Congress. They're celebrated stars of the Democratic Party, and they both explicitly support the boycott of Israel. So you have some members of the Democratic Party, like Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer, who say that boycotting Israel is anti-Semitic. But now you have this new generation of Democrats who are much more critical of Israel, including two who support the boycott. It's spread on U.S. campuses. It's spreading throughout Western Europe. There are Jewish groups who are so offended by the occupation that they now support the boycott of Israel. So you're absolutely right, Juan. The reason why there's a worldwide effort to criminalize and suppress and punish it is precisely because they worry that the same thing will happen to Israel as what happened to the apartheid regime in the 1980s in South Africa when they were targeted with an identical boycott, which is the regime and their repression finally fell. And that's what they're most concerned about.
Glenn, I wanted to read the beginning of a piece just out by University of Michigan professor Juan Cole. He writes, and he's writing about Airbnb. He says, the living space sharing company Airbnb on Monday denied an allegation by the Israeli tourism minister that it had suspended its delisting of apartments in Israeli squatter settlements, which are Jewish only in the Palestinian West Bank. Airbnb has to boycott the Israeli squatter settlements because they are illegal. The European Union has for some time imposed some sorts of boycott on settlement institutions and requires the labeling of settler goods, and a full economic boycott is under consideration in countries like Ireland. He goes on to say the argument sometimes heard is that Airbnb is treating the squatters differently than it does other disputed territories. It's a stupid argument and quite dishonest, writes Professor Cole. There aren't any other countries that are keeping 5 million people stateless and without citizenship in a state and gradually usurping all their rights and property. Can you talk about this? For example, Airbnb.
The Airbnb case is really interesting because they didn't say they were going to delist all apartments or properties in Israel proper. They said only in the occupied territory of the West Bank, which the UN at the end of 2016 ruled was an illegal occupation. And one of the interesting things about the Texas law that makes it so offensive is it not only bars people from boycotting companies in Israel, but also Israeli companies in the West Bank. You're not even allowed to do the milder, more mainstream version of the boycott aimed just at the illegal settlements in the West Bank that even the UN said was illegal. And now there's a dispute. Has Airbnb really caved into the pressure and reversed their policy? Israel says they have. Airbnb is denying it. But that's where these laws that we've been just talking about come into play and are so pernicious. Imagine if you're an Airbnb executive, you could stand to lose a lot of state business because there's so many laws now in so many states, and it might be national, barring governments from entering into contracts with you as a company if you in any way boycott Israel. And this is the coordination that they're trying to impose to prevent this kind of boycott from succeeding.
That was Glenn Greenwald reporting on the state-by-state strategy of the Israeli lobby to outlaw support of the Palestinian BDS movement. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى